a dynamic improviser known for her boundary-pushing approach to the trumpet. Further information and tickets available at cap.ucla.edu and kpfk.org.
You're listening to KPFK, 90.7 FM in Los Angeles, and on the web at kpfk.org.
This is Feminist Magazine, a weekly radical radio show and podcast produced by a diverse collective of feminists. And every week, we bring you a mix of intersectional stories and guests to help you resist and engage. And I'm Lynn Harris-Ballin, your host today, and this is what feminism can sound like. As organizers and activists, we've all been in those meetings, you know, the ones where we need to make decisions as a group or to vision a larger goal. And those kinds of meetings can be a struggle. They can be filled with lots of egos and unspoken agendas. Our guest today is Adrienne Marie Brown. She's an author, a visionary thinker, and so much more. And she has a book called Holding Change that offers a profound way to transform that process in meetings and in larger movement building in a time that we really so deeply need to shift the ways we work together and envision our future. So welcome to Feminist Magazine, Adrienne.
Thank you, Lynn. It's good to be here. Thanks for having me.
So many exciting and expansive ideas to talk about here, but tell our listeners a little bit about what can holding change look like?
You know, for years before I was formally a facilitator, I didn't know that there was a language for facilitation, for what it was. It was just something that kept happening. You know, I'd be in a meeting like, we need some synthesis, or we need an agenda, or we need, we feel stuck. Like, how can we get through this moment? And my friend, Mia Herndon, who is now part of the Emergent Strategy collective with me, she was the first person to hire me to facilitate. And over the years, I would find myself using different terminology to try to explain what it was I was doing. And one of the emergent terminologies was holding space. People would say, we're holding space. And that was made a lot of sense to me. It's just like we're really creating and holding a space in which humans can move through the difficult with each other with as much ease as possible. And once Emergent Strategy came out, what became interesting to me was that it wasn't just that we were holding a space in which anything could happen or in which stagnation was cool. We were really trying to hold a space in which change could happen, meaning that the individuals in the space felt like they could change and that was okay, that there was room for them to change, and that the relationships between the people in the space could change, and then that the group altogether could take seriously the fact that they were trying to change the world. And that's what, you know, people who are doing social justice, people who are doing movement work, it's basically people who are like shamelessly saying, there's some things with this world that could change and we believe in our capacity to shape that. It's also an homage to Octavia E. Butler, who in some way, I think all of my work, I always try to touch back to the stone of wisdom that she offered us with so many of her texts, but particularly in the parables, she talks about change and shaping change, being a shaper as opposed to a victim of change. And I feel like that's the call, especially right now when circumstances are so overwhelming, both externally and within movement. It's such an overwhelming thing to try to be like with each other and hold each other. But Octavia said, all that you touch, you change, and all that you change, changes you. And for facilitators and mediators, what we're doing is holding that, holding the changes that happen inevitably when we are in contact with each other, which we have to be on this tiny planet. So that's all the stuff that's happening in that title and in the book.
So much happening in the title. And a sentence that really resonated for me is the impossibility of consensus calls us to find ways of working together in difference.
You know, when I first started working in movement, I naively believed that, oh, if we just all had the same information to work from, we would all reach the same conclusions, and then we would flow forward together in a heavenly, you know, Garden of Eden-like existence. And, you know, and so I became obsessed with data initially, you know, like, let's get all the information. Let's make sure we have all the information. And then, of course, you know, what happens with humans, which is we have all the same information. We reach different conclusions because we come from different walks, different socializations, different perspectives, different needs. Many of our needs are unmet, you know, and unnamed. And so we're coming into any space. The difference is actually the point. And I didn't really understand that until I started really studying the natural world more and studying the patterns of emergence and really starting to understand that in a healthy ecosystem, the biodiversity is the health, right? The number of different ways of being that can coexist is a sign of the health. And so then I started thinking, well, what if we facilitated that way? What if we facilitated where the invitation was to have as many different ways of being in the room as possible, but to find ways to align ourselves in emotion towards futures that could sustain all those differences rather than futures that could only sustain one way of being. And that has become and continues to be of deep interest to me because I keep changing also. Like, I keep changing as an individual. So it's not even, it's just like each person is the same unto themselves throughout their lives. Right? It's like we are coming into being and we're changing constantly. We're changing each other. We don't want to achieve a consensus that requires everyone being the same way and thinking the same things. And Loretta Ross has a beautiful quote about this, which is a group of people moving the same direction and thinking the same thing is a cult. A group of people thinking different things but moving in the same direction is a movement. And that, you know, I feel like it's such a teaching that it's like, how do we be a biodiverse movement that allows for the many different ways of being, right, to exist? I think disability justice is a great teacher of this also, right? It's like, how do we resist the idea that there's some norm that we're all supposed to achieve and some singular way of thinking that is correct? And instead, how do we embrace the fact that we're complex and we're changing?
Right. And I mean, you've partly started to answer this, but the title of the book is actually Holding Change, the Way of Emergent Strategy, Facilitation and Mediation.
Yes.
So it's part of a series based on your thinking around this idea of emergent strategy, which was your 2017 book. And it's about how we can partner with change,
yes.
Right?
Yes.
So it's a very multi-layered concept, but can you tell our listeners a little bit more about that? It's so fundamental.
Yeah. So, you know, looking at the natural world, there's certain elements and there's certain principles that if you pay attention, seem to be present throughout all of the functional systems. So adaptation, intentional adaptation, being able to adapt in ways that move us towards life. Life continuously moves towards life. Fractals, like there's some patterns that move from the smallest scale to the largest scale. Interdependence, right? That in nature, everything is in relationships with each other. Nothing is trying to be an individual pulling itself up by its bootstraps in spite of everyone else, you know? And the species that are surviving have these patterns. And emergent strategy was starting to ask the question, what would it look like if humans humbled ourselves to find our patterns and to be in pattern with everything else? And the question, I don't know if you've ever sat and watched a murmuration of birds move through the sky, but they're avoiding predation and there's some guidelines to how they do it. And I started thinking, like, what would it look like if our movement was like a flock of birds? What would it look like if our movement was a murmuration? If we could trust each other, if we had the right space from each other, if we understood ourselves to be a body in motion rather than a bunch of bodies at odds with each other. So emergent strategy was that first offering. And then I've been gathering different texts and ideas and thoughts that went with it. But something people kept asking me about was like, well, how do you do facilitation? Because I get a lot of positive feedback about my facilitation. People are like, oh, you're so great at this. And I'm like, some of it is not nature, which I put that in Holding Change. There is a nature. There's some people who I think have a nature that orients around and makes it easy to do facilitation. Like, it's in us. We pay attention in a certain way. But some of it can be learned. And I think everyone should have at least a basic concept of it, a basic capacity for it. because we need it in our families, we need it in our communities, right. We need it in our workplace. Even if we're not explicitly doing organizing, we need to be able to be in right relationship with each other. So holding change is my offer towards that. And there's a little bow to the Taoist text, which is the Tao Te Ching, because, you know, they talk about the way that can be named is not the way. Like, immediately, as soon as you try to say it, you know, like trying to put in a book, like, here's how I do what I do, I knew that there were some things that would never be translatable or couldn't go on the page. I'm still doing my best to offer the way of emergent strategy facilitation and mediation. And to that end, I have a lot of contributors in the book, a whole series of other Black feminists who are alive and working right now, who have different ways than I do. And I thought that that was a way of nodding to that, right? That it's like, it's not actually one way. The way is a complex offering of ways of adapting together, breathing together, listening to each other, leaning into each other, grieving together, growing together.
Right. And let's talk about that. You've got this deeply significant section of writings under the heading Black Feminist Wisdom.
Yes.
And it includes some of my personal favorite movement writers, thinkers, organizers. Yeah. I mean, particularly like Alexis Pauline Gums and Melchior Cyril. And you talk about being part of a lineage, right, as a facilitator. What does that lineage mean? And how do these particular writers that you invited in, how do they hold that lineage with you?
Yeah. Well, you know, for me, I think there's a moment when you recognize nothing we're doing is being done for the first time. You know, Octavia talks about, like, there's nothing new under the sun, but there are new suns. And I love that idea of, like, how do we, in our work, honor the fact that, like, there's nothing new. We learned this from ancestors. You know, when we look back at the people that we honor as organizers, really a lot of what they were doing was also facilitation, right? They were gathering, they were synthesizing, they were helping people figure out what moves could happen. That's a core piece of what it means to be moving other humans along in any shape. So some of them that are quoted in the book are Ella Baker, Fannie Lou Hamer, Harriet Tubman. These are people who I think of as a lineage of Black women, Black feminists who pointed the way, helped gather, helped listen, helped to decenter, right? They were like, it's not about me. You have to make a choice to opt into history. You have to make a choice to opt into your potential and your greatness. So for me, the lineage is there. And then I think if you look at most of those people in the book, all of them are people who I've seen name explicitly. Oh, I'm in the lineage of Audre Lorde. Adaku Utah, who offers us the care bear, the care bear approach of these care teams that allow a room to care for itself and create a community culture of care. She says that she partnered with Harriet Tubman in her work to create Harriet's Apothecary and create a healing arm inside of movement, right? A lot of the people in the book, Alexis is one of the first people who really gave me direct access to a lot of the lineage by saying, we need to take these words of Audre Lorde, I am who I am, doing what I came to do, and we need to chant them, and we need to let them be embodied in us. Harriet Tubman said, my people are free, not will be free, but are free. You know, how do I embody that? So I think these people, one of the things that I wanted to do was shine a light on them while they're alive, right? And say, like, you are a part of Black movements, and you're part of multiracial movements, and you're part of movements for change in large part because of these people. These people are behind the scenes, holding space, holding change, holding connections, mediating conversations, helping people create safer spaces, helping people think about security, helping people think about boundaries. Like, these are these Black women who are behind the scenes doing this work. And often they don't get seen until they've passed and, you know, people are like, okay, now let's give them their flowers. But I'm like, they're alive. You can access their wisdom right now. You know, they're going to continue to learn and change and write, and you should be paying attention to them. So that's what felt important to me. And to have also expressions where it was like, it wasn't just Black feminists who were femme presenting or femme identifying, but it was a wide spectrum of Black feminists who I included in the text, because that also feels important to understand in the current moment. But I think that they are the lineage for any future generations of movement. right? We are the lineage, and I wanted to name ourselves and weave ourselves in explicitly. Like, here's what we are thinking about. Here's something that we have to offer. Here's some things that we know.
We're talking to Adrienne Marie Brown about her book, Holding Change. So lineage in the sense of it's not a past thing that you sort of look at and polish and put on a shelf, but it's current and living and woven in. Yeah.
Yeah, I feel like one of the things that Indigenous worldview holds is that seven generations back, seven generations ahead,
right,
that you're actually always in the river that has directions of flow in both ways. And something about that to me is like, well, then how do I be a responsible future ancestor, as well as how do I responsibly receive what has been offered to me?
They're talking about things like breathing and boundaries and, you know, space, safe space or not safe space. There's actually both. And also the ways of facilitation that you offer are all deeply part of feminist thought. And yet so much we hear sort of the 101, like the equal rights and the, but I love that you bring in all of this kind of deeper and more horizontal, collaborative, those aspects of feminism that sometimes we forget, right?
Absolutely. I mean, I think that we can get so caught up in contending for what's the definition, what's the way that it's done, and we really can focus on the mistakes that have been made. Every movement is constantly making mistakes. And I think there's, my thing is, I don't think there's failure. I think there's data. And I think we can harness that data. I think we can say, oh, what did first wave feminism push and open and do? And what was the data? What did we learn? What did second wave feminism do? What did we learn? Where does intersectionality open new pathways for us? And what did we learn? Right. And to me, if you hold it that way, what we're learning all along is there are different ways for us to be leaders. There are different ways for us to be in community. And if you have a balance where all the different parts of a society are held equally in shaping those ways, all of a sudden new possibilities come into being. And my partner is someone who studies masculinity and masculinity outside of the idea of being something that only men have or can practice or can do.
Right.
And I think about this all the time that I'm like, we're on the precipice of gender opening and breaking wide and really starting to understand it in such a different way. And to me, feminism is a core part of how that happened for me. Is that I understood that I was like, oh, what I was given and told were the roles of gender are false. And if those are false, then I can start to shape for myself what it means to be in this world and be a human being taking responsibility for the conditions. And all the people in this book are folks who I see that way.
It's all part of sort of unraveling hierarchy in a sense, right? And my favorite phrase, you know, there are so many labels, but my favorite is really the umbrella of gender expansive.
Exactly. You know, so much of what's happening anytime we're holding a room is that we are trying to help people move past the constructs that we have been given in this period of history. And 100 years ago, they had different constructs, some of which are still holding on for dear life, some of which have shifted, right? But right now we have these constructs. We have white supremacy. We know white people are not supreme, right, to anyone. It's just, right, but there's the construct. We have patriarchy. We know men are not supreme. So we have the constructs of gender. We have these constructs of even what work and life are, right? There's all these boxes. And when you're facilitating, you're trying to help people move beyond those boxes into a sense of us, into a sense of the we, into a sense of like, what are the gifts I have to give? And what do I need from this group? And then how can this group shape what the community needs? And that deconstructing, right, is where it gets really exciting and really interesting. If you're with facilitation that is curious about, you know, who is in this room and what is possible.
Well, thank you so much, Adrienne Marie Brown, for joining us to talk about your book, Holding Change. You can support KPFK and our show today, Feminist Magazine. Just go to the kpfk.org website and click the donate button. It's easy. Or you can call 818-985-5735 or 818-985-KPFK. If you do that right now, your conscience is clear. You have done it for this fun drive, and then you can go back to listening to the rest of the show. And that is just one example of the kind of story we love to highlight. Feminist Magazine brings you voices like that, and also feminist artists and creatives, plus, of course, local activists telling you ways that you can take action and make a difference yourself. And you can support us to keep us doing that right now. You can just go to the kpfk.org website and click the donate button, or you can call 818-985-5735 or 818-985-KPFK.
That's what is good about KPFK. You do get it that it's the people, not the manufacturers that are selling us all the cheap soap and toothpaste and general unhealthy junk. But it's really information that is quite usable. I'm Joyce Clark from Bellingham, Washington. I listen to KPFK as much as I possibly can, and I do support it.
KPFK, 90.7 FM Los Angeles, 98.7 FM Santa Barbara, and if you're in Bellingham or anywhere else in the world, www.kpfk.org.
As a KPFK listener, you expect to hear smart conversations about important issues every time you turn on the radio. We bring you facts and analysis, not partisanship or hype, so you can form your own opinions on the news. You count on KPFK for informed, insightful reporting. Don't take coverage like this for granted. It's here for you, thanks to the generous financial support of our listeners. Support the programming you rely on right now by calling 818-985-5735 or contribute online at kpfk.org.
You're listening to Feminist Magazine on KPFK on 90.7 FM and kpfk.org. I'm your host today, Lynn Harris-Ballin. And coming up next...
For me, as a paraplegic, this wheelchair is an extension of my body. It's not just a mobility device. And I think a lot of people can't grasp the concept that when you grab a person's wheelchair, who uses a wheelchair all day, every day, you're grabbing their body.
What happens to a disabled body that does not produce at the rate of capitalism? It becomes ejected. It becomes labeled as deficient and inefficient against a system that is totally arbitrary and are absolutely external to the life of the body.
On today's episode, Disability, Our Culture, Ourselves, we'll take you on a bus ride in Seattle to experience a day in the life of a disabled passenger. And we'll hear from Sarah Acevedo, a disability studies scholar who explores culture and identity from within the disabled community.
When I claim or tell someone, oh, I'm autistic, and they're like, don't you mean you have autism? Because, like, you're human first. And so that makes me think what autistic people are inhuman inherently.
That was Professor Acevedo. Now let's hear from disability rights activist Dorian Taylor and the particular challenges they face while accessing public transportation as a paraplegic. Here's contributor Mona Ye with a report.
How you doing? Thank you.
Hi, I'm Mona Ye. That was Dorian Taylor getting on a bus with me. We rode from Dorian's home in Tukwila to the South Downtown neighborhood in Seattle. Dorian is paraplegic and a wheelchair user due to a traumatic incident with police 5 years ago. Dorian moved to Seattle to seek better medical services and is now training for competitive sprint kayaking. Here's the dispatch.
To get the training, I travel from Tukwila to Bothell. It's about a two-hour trip one way. I don't drive. Access is also very unreliable, so I catch the bus for everything. I do most of my own grocery shopping, go to doctor's appointments. It's my main method of transportation besides my wheelchair. For me, as a paraplegic, this wheelchair is an extension of my body. It's not just a mobility device. It was literally, specifically built for my paralysis level, for my sensation. And I think a lot of people can't grasp the concept that when you grab a person's wheelchair who uses a wheelchair all day, every day, you're grabbing their body. You're grabbing their physical person. I get a lot of that. Like, people will just grab me and drag me. And passengers, when I speak up about this, bus drivers tend to ignore it because they're just trying to help. And as a female assigned person, that puts me in a tricky situation because I've had people that weren't just trying to help. And I don't get the same amount of protection as anybody else. The chances are they're going to defend the person that grabbed me. We're not used to seeing people with physical disabilities be independent. That reflects on the policies of Metro, and it reflects on how somebody like myself, who is pretty independent and can strap themselves in and all this, it's how we're treated on the bus. So people don't act like I know what I'm doing. They act like they're going to know my mobility aid or how to strap it on better than me. I think a lot of people also don't realize how much these cost. This is $6,000. Just the cushion alone is $700. This seat back's $800. That alone should be a reason why a bus driver should just listen to you when you're talking about your mobility aid. An electric chair, you're looking at $30,000 or $40,000. I need this. Like, this is my everything, you know? It's considered damage to private property. It's not considered bodily injury. But if you break my wheelchair, I feel like you injured my body because you've literally destroyed my mobility. You've destroyed the ability for me to just go to the bathroom without crawling. It's really hard to explain to bus drivers that not every single chair is the same. Not every single wheelchair user is the same. Like, you don't have the same mobility as she does, so why would I have the same mobility and the same needs as the next person whose wheelchair is like you can buy at Walgreens? I've had bus drivers, I'll let myself unstrap myself, go up to the edge of the, to wait for them to put the ramp down. I've had bus drivers grab me by the chest, like I'm just going to roll off the bus while they're in the middle of putting the ramp down. And I had a bus driver literally tell me, well, I'm just doing my job. And so your job is to grab people and treat them like children. You know, I've got left before to the point that when I used to catch the 120 downtown, houseless people would stand in front of me to make sure I got on the bus because they got tired of seeing me left. I've had a bus driver pass me up at the bus stop because he wasn't looking down. And then stop, but tell me I couldn't get on because he didn't want to let the ramp down in the grass. And this is the same bus driver that refused to tell a blind person where their stop was because they didn't have a white cane, you know. And it's such an issue. When I started working with the Transit Riders Union and reading the policies, well, the problem is in the policies. First of all, they basically tell somebody. Tell the bus drivers, you know, you need to make sure this person is safe, but there's never anything about consent. There's never anything about the person might know their safety better than the next person. When I lived in Portland and when I was in New York City, you actually have the option of whether or not you can strap yourself in, because in reality, it's actually really dangerous for me, for my chair to be strapped in. Because if the bus gets in a wreck, I'm just going to fly out of my chair. If I was just locked with my wheel locks, I'd be fine. Like, that's how I rode in New York. That's how I rode in Portland. But here, it's actually really unsafe, and it's causing all of this damage to my wheelchair on top of it. Damage to the alignment, replacing screws and bolts and things like that. Your only other option, if you don't want to fly out of your chair, is to be restrained. That's where you got straps. So I couldn't even, like, grab what I needed to grab to take care of myself. So that's not an option either. The main problem I feel with the policy is they glance over it, and there's no actual training on how to interact with people with physical disabilities. And if you see the way people with physical disabilities are treated in our society in general, we're infantilized in a lot of ways. So the problem that we get with teaching it as an afterthought, and there being absolutely no consent in the policy, and the policy itself being really patronizing, we have these different interpretations. So you have a bus driver that will let you on first, let you strap yourself in. You have bus drivers that lie to me and tell me that the policy and how you strap yourself in is completely different. Like, oh, you have to strap yourself this way and that way. Yesterday, I get on the bus. He strapped my tire both here and here on the hand rims. First of all, this is quick release. So that's like the most dangerous place to lock up your chair. So I told him, I said, oh, next time, could you not strap that here? Because just so you know, that's a really unsafe place to strap wheelchairs, especially everyday wheelchairs. And I showed him this. And then he started giving me hassle. And then I noticed that my wheels had been a little wobbly. So I was like pushing off the bus. And I was like, look, I'm the one that ends up paying for the damage. And these wheels cost $700. Then he tells me, you just tell me how to strap it up. And I was like, you know, actually, next time I ride your bus, I'll strap myself on, save the hassles. And he told me straight up, the next time you get on my bus, I'm not letting you on. And that's actually a pretty mild incident. But what had me call is I went to push up the hill and my tires are wobbly because they were pulled by the here. These are $700 rims. I cannot afford new wheels. Because of how I end up paralyzed, I've got pretty bad PTSD and people grabbing me, you know, without my permission, it sets that off. So I'm not in a good mood when I ride the bus. And I have to prepare myself mentally to be able to catch the bus. And I have all my things on my person, like super close. I make sure that there's nothing that would even make anybody want to just reach out and grab me. Like, I try to make sure, like, everything's just in order so no one will touch me.
All right.
That's it.
Actually, do you mind putting him right here?
Sure.
Yeah, thank you. That's where my chair folds down, so that's a hinge.
Oh, there.
Yeah, yeah. I got red tape on the one side and ran out on the other. Thank you. Uh-huh. No, that was golden.
We were fortunate enough to have a hassle-free experience on this bus ride. However, Dorian's reality is that every day and every ride is unpredictable. Before leaving the house, Dorian has to mentally prepare for the ride. Amidst constant healthcare trips, the long commutes from Tukwila to Bothell for kayaking offer critical value to Dorian's life.
I just needed something. I was going to snap. I was going to lose it. That's how I got involved in sports, and that's why I like kayaking so much, because it's the only place I can be where I don't think about all of that.
That was a ride-along with Dorian Taylor. Dorian is currently working on communicating with Metro Services to find ways they can better serve individuals with disabilities. Dorian is carrying forward the efforts of the disability rights movement that began in the 1960s and continues today. The main slogan of that movement is, "Nothing about us without us," meaning no policy should be decided without the full and direct participation of those affected by that policy. The story of Dorian Taylor was produced by Yuko Kadama and Mona Yeh in partnership with KBCS and Finding America. You're listening to Disability, Our Culture, Ourselves, on Making Contact. Up next, we'll hear disability studies scholar Sarah Acevedo break down the powerful ways that common language and terminology can shape our perceptions of disability, and why even today we are seeing further exclusion of disabled people.
Everything disability is grassroots. Just think about that. Like, the history of disability rights in the first place is grassroots. Like, people climbing the Capitol steps, throwing themselves out of their wheelchairs, throwing their crutches, climbing those steps, invading, like sort of occupying, right? Those were people, everyday disabled people who were being intently marginalized from every aspect of everyday life. And sort of like how disability studies kind of was born out of those grassroots struggles and became institutionalized. As it so happens that grassroots knowledge becomes institutionalized and co-opted and sort of reinvented or reincorporated into this wheel of reproduction, not only in terms of like reproducing exchangeable goods. We understand education as an exchangeable good,
right? Which is a heartache. But also in terms of like this absorption of knowledge, knowledges in plural, turning it into this top-down approach to, oh, this is like the seriousness of the fact because we have put it in an academic book, right? And I am not whatsoever excusing myself from that because I am very much a part of it. I reproduce disability as anybody else who studies disability as a disabled person. And let me tell you, as a disabled person, I prefer to be studied by, obviously I want to study alongside somebody. I rather that disability issues are taken up by disabled academics. Let me tell you the truth. And as much as I wish, for instance, that I could go to therapy and my therapist was autistic, you know, sort of like entering. And so disability studies is kind of in this like sort of like sort of strategic infiltration space of like, let's legitimize our grassroots struggles and like sort of institutionalize them so that they are recognized within this sort of like matrix of dominant knowledge and sort of like ways of producing knowledge that are considered legitimate because they have a seal, because they're accredited, right? And so doing, there is a process of separation of disability studies from disability grassroots struggles. Like, there's no doubt that that occurs. It occurs with anthropology. It occurs with sociology, right? And with many other disciplines. So, and I'm telling you all this because I want to talk about a model of understanding disability, the disability experience that was emerged from the work of disabled grassroots activists in Britain in the 1970s. And that they were working together, so disabled activists who were living in the community with disabled people who were still institutionalized and being brutalized and dehumanized within institutions of care for the disabled. So working in collaboration, they started thinking about the ways in which society disables different bodies.
You can support KPFK and our show today, Feminist Magazine. Just go to the kpfk.org website and click the donate button. It's easy. If you do that right now, your conscience is clear. You have done it for this fun drive, and then you can go back to listening to the rest of the show. Or you can call 818-985-5735 or 818-985-KPFK. And that is just one example of the kind of story we love to highlight. So Feminist Magazine brings you voices like that, and also feminist artists and creatives, plus, of course, local activists telling you ways that you can take action, you know, grassroots action, and make a difference yourself. That is what we actually mean when we say at the top of our show every week that we're bringing you a mix of intersectional stories and guests to help you resist and engage. And you can support us to keep us doing that right now. You can just go to the kpfk.org website and click the donate button. You can give $10, $25, $50, $100, or become a sustaining member. We want to be a sustainable radio station. And so if you just give us your credit card, we do a monthly payment. You choose how much. And then it's a sustainable way to keep bringing you these stories. Site is kpfk.org, and there's a donate button. You are listening to Feminist Magazine on KPFK, 90.7 FM and kpfk.org.
Hi, I'm Andrea Martin. You might forget me from the 80s. KPFK is listener-supported public radio in Los Angeles that refuses to take money from corporations. They didn't refuse, however, to take money from me, and all I have left to show for it is a biodegradable tote bag to store all my other biodegradable tote bags in, and a bumper sticker, which they happily said was mine to enjoy. If only I hadn't donated my car to KPFK, I would have a bumper to stick it on. So please join me in showing your support by calling 818-985-5735. That's 818-985-KAPUFKA or online kpfk.org. I'm Andrea Martin, and trust me, all the money you give goes directly toward keeping the lights on, and in my estimation, should be dimmer because these carpets haven't been cleaned since the 80s, which you might forget me from.
Hi, I'm Patti Smith, and you're listening to Fiercely Independent Pacifica Radio, KPFK, 90.7 FM. People have the power.
You're listening to Feminist Magazine on KPFK on 90.7 FM and kpfk.org. I'm your host today, Lynn Harris-Ballin. And coming up next...
Right, so there's an active process that happens, and that process is called the process of disablement, right? So those that given fancy terms were brought into academia by disabled British sociologists, drawing from this experiences of grassroots struggles and brought it to bear onto this model that had prevailed the history of any study of disability. Not disability studies, that's different. Any study of disability, about disability, on disability without disabled people. And it's known in disability studies as the biomedical or individual model of disability, which understands disabled bodies as inherently, individually deficient. So it is a problem. It's an inherent problem of the body. It has nothing to do with the societal circumstances, ideologies, practices, attitudes, institutional approaches to different embodiment, right? No, the disability is just a natural, organic occurrence, and it's a deficit. Needs to be cured, needs to be hidden, needs to be manicured, needs to be prostheticized, needs to be handled, needs to be observed in confinement, right? So this has been the tradition, right? The long Western tradition of understanding and managing and administering the disabled body through a biomedical perspective. That, unfortunately, is the perspective that continues to prevail today after 40, 50 years of struggles by disabled people, grassroots academics, in collaboration, artists, performers, poets. You name it, there is still this understanding of disability from this deficit perspective. So these academics, like this British sociologist, were trying to be like, look, these people on the ground, they talked about a social perspective of disability, which locates the problem outside the body. It is not different embodiment. It is not the different body, different. That also in quotation marks, that's inherently problematic, that's inherently burdensome, or that's inherently abnormal, right? It is actually the social structures, practices, policies, institutions, interpersonal relationships that produce disability into a category of deficiency, and therefore a category of social oppression in every aspect of life, right? So in doing so, this battle sort of begun, right? It was like disabled intellectuals fighting against the rest of the world in terms of like this academic traditions and like schools of thought that had been like totally established in disabled academics and intellectuals, not even disability studies yet, but just like within sociology. We're like, look at us, we're disabled, we're talking to you. And the disciplines are like, you can't possibly be an academic, you can't possibly be an intellectual because you're disabled. So we don't know what you're talking about, right? So it's this power relationship and this imbalance between both two camps, so to speak. And so it happens that the social model has informed so many of our contemporary struggles. It continues to do so because it brings the idea of disability to bear on the material reality, concrete reality of the disabled body, of disabled bodies, in a way that we cease to exist within this platonic realm of ideas and narratives and metaphor, because disability is a very useful metaphor, let me tell you. For writers, oh my God. It's like the primer, like, let's go to disability and use all this imagery about collapsing societies through the image of the disabled body, right? In a way as to detach it completely from the realm of material experience. And in doing so, from our lives, from the very experience of disability, from living disability. So living disability is embodying disability. Which we do, which disabled people do. We embody that thing. We celebrate that thing. We struggle with that thing. But in insisting on an erasure of disability and disabled people from producing everyday life and from producing the world, that's why we continue to circulate as metaphors. As charity cases are pitiful. That is not how we understand ourselves. That is not how we see ourselves. That is not how we represent ourselves. Disability culture, huge depth, vibrancy, richness, multi-layeredness of experience and deliciousness, and just like multifaceted ways of looking at our bodies in a three-dimensional perspective as opposed to these flat allegories. One of these examples in the Bay, like Be Proud, Sins Invalid, and Latif is part of Sins Invalid. It is this performance troupe of disabled artists of color centering queer and gender non-conforming experiences and bringing sexuality and sensuality in your face. Because the medicalized experience or representation of disability is the perpetual infant body, the non-sexual body, right? That is the mainstream that is completely dissonant with the way we live our lives and experience our bodies as pleasurable. We experience this body, our bodies as pleasurable. We experience our bodies as oppressed. We experience our bodies as interdependent. We experience our bodies as this huge amalgamation of greatness, of possibility, of hope, outside of this binary construction of the deficit and the perfect body. What is the perfect body? What is the able body? Doesn't the able body need the disabled body in order to exist? Doesn't it need to be constructed again, like in tandem? Like, how else do you define an able body? Everything that a disabled body isn't is the able body. So we're still needed. Like, the able body needs us, disabled bodies, to reproduce itself in this hegemonic, hierarchical way. So this division, like, think about the division between normality, quote unquote, and abnormality, which are both historical. They're constructs. Like, abnormality and normality don't just exist in a vacuum of like organicity, or that's just the way it is. Things are the way they are. their white supremacy is just a natural occurrence of the hierarchical, you know, like it isn't. It is a product of social relations that exist within very specific value systems and ideologies. So what I wanted to do today, mostly, was invite you to, like, really think beyond the binary. To just really dig deeper and look at the contradictions that exist, like, beyond, within, and the outside of those binaries that are so limiting and are so oppressive. So another thing that I see so often with my students and just people in general, that's been like a really rich terrain of addressing this from the perspective not of a professor who teaches stuff about disability. No, as a disabled professor who teaches about disability studies, is this an engagement with ableist language, everyday ableist language. So yes, metaphorical iterations, but in a more sort of like everyday sort of casual way. Oh, the weather is so OCD. That is an insane film. People don't usually think too deeply about the histories that exist behind the usage of these labels and these words. They have a history. Just as much as the construction of normality and abnormality has a history, these words that we use so casually in such arbitrary ways today, that's crazy, OCD, I was blinded by it, I was blind to it, it was a blind spot, you know, it's a crotch, the economy's crippled, which is not the same as reclaiming crip culture, let me tell you. That's a very different iteration right there. There is a history. And the history is a history of brutalization. The brutalization of disabled bodies in the creation of nation states. And the separation of bodies and stratification of bodies again in terms of who belongs and who doesn't belong. I mean, we can't give citizenship to everybody. We gotta create citizenship in a dialectic with non-citizenship, because then how can citizenship exist on its own? We gotta create nationals and immigrants. I mean, otherwise, what is the one doesn't exist without the other in this very dialectical oppressive tension, which is also a tension that produces resistance. The deployment of ableist language to create affect among audiences at the expense of disabled people. You know? So, yes, the histories behind these deployments are really torturous. They are real. They are part of a history that's been mostly erased from dominant understandings of the body. And those are the histories of the asylum, in conjunction with the birth of psychiatry in the 19th century, scientific racism, and the production, the systematic production of these labels that would then determine humanity and non-humanity, humanity and subhumanity.
So you can support KPFK and our show today, Feminist Magazine. Just go to the kpfk.org website and click that donate button. Or call 818-985-5735 or 818-985-KPFK. And that is just one example of the kind of story we love to highlight. So Feminist Magazine brings you voices like that, and also feminist artists and creatives, plus, of course, local activists telling you ways that you can take action, you know, grassroots action, and make a difference yourself. That is what we actually mean when we say at the top of our show every week that we're bringing you a mix of intersectional stories and guests to help you resist and engage. So during this fund drive, and we're limiting the number of interruptions and preemptions so that your favorite programs like this one can keep going on the air, providing you with the information and the news that you can only get on KPFK. So please show your support for the station and for this approach. We want you to kind of vote with your actions and say, yeah, we want to keep having programming. But the way we'll know that is if you support us. We want to keep doing this approach to fundraising, but you can do your part by pledging online, kpfk.org, or call 818-985-5735. If it's been a while since you last donated, even if you've never donated before, if you've been listening but you've never donated before, there's no time like the present. Don't procrastinate. So do it now and make a generous donation, as generous as you can, to keep KPFK part of your daily life, to keep Feminist Magazine part of your weekly life. We're in challenging times and your contribution really is vitally important. So we thank you for your help and support. We thank you on behalf of all of the other listeners and all of us right here at KPFK. We work as a collective of diverse voices and contributors. And like that whole thing of diverse voices is not just a set of differences, but a way to kind of come together, collaborate, and make something bigger and better. And that's what we do on our show, Feminist Magazine. And that's what KPFK does as well. So it means that there's a bunch of viewpoints giving you, our listeners, all kinds of perspectives, stories, and guests every week. And it goes across generations too. We mentor new contributors here on Feminist Magazine. We love doing that. We love teaching radio skills like interviewing, engineering, and editing to young college students, to grassroots feminists from different communities across the city. And all of us who are part of the show are activists in different communities around LA, but we give our time and sweat to FemMag because we believe in radio. Go to kpfk.org and click donate if you want this to keep happening, to keep going, and these kinds of stories, this kind of work, to be there every week for you. We're inviting you to give $100 or be a sustainer, and that is amazing. You give us your credit card, you say how much you want to donate every month, and then it's automatically taken out. You don't have to worry about it. We have a sustainable base that we can work from, that we can build from. And all through this past lockdown and pandemic, we have all kept going remotely for you. So show us a little love, won't you? Go to kpfk.org and click that donate button right now to support the show. So we're wrapping up another edition of Feminist Magazine. Thanks to all our guests and contributors today. And now is your last chance to support KPFK in this hour, in the Feminist Magazine hour. So if you like what you just heard on Feminist Magazine, please support us to keep doing that. Go to kpfk.org and click the donate button or call 818-985-5735. And thank you.
America. What's going on, Los Angeles? My name is Kat Brooks. I'm a boots-on-the-ground organizer, artist, abolitionist, and the host of Law & Disorder. Born at KPFA in the Bay 3 years ago, L&D seeks to be a partner in movement by making space and place for the freedom fighters locked out of mainstream media, artists using their work as active resistance, and connecting with our brothers and sisters on the other side of the walls. You can tune in for that fire Monday through Thursdays at 8 a.m. on 90.7 FM or online at kpfk.org.
Support comes from UCLA Center for the Art of Performance, presenting Lucia on October 10th at the Nimoy. The breakout 24-year-old jazz songstress, known for her collaborations with Natalia Lafourcade and Allo Black, strikes out on her own with a self-titled album that is a perfect union of her Latin folk roots and American jazz influences. Further information and tickets available at cap.ucla.edu and kpfk.org.
por la blanda arena que lame el mar, su pequeña huella no vuelve más.
ICE is escalating deportation operations around the Los Angeles area. But if you are stopped by ICE officers, you have constitutional rights, regardless of your immigration status.